Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
All right, Mason and Ireland show. Mason's taking the day off. Brian Kamenetsky's here. Ramona Shelburne will be joining us shortly. Which would make a lot more sense when you listen to Morales' Open. You know, Brian, one of the things that I wanted to get into, and we'll get Ramona in on it too, is we had a fast-track question the other day about Ken Burns, the baseball documentarian, is upset. He's not just baseball documentarian. He does documentaries on all subjects. Says that The Last Dance, the Bulls doc, is not a real documentary because Michael Jordan has some say over what's in it. And I thought to myself, why should that determine whether or not it's good? Does it bother you that The Last Dance has, that Michael Jordan has some editorial control over The Last Dance?
I mean, would I prefer in a perfect world? Yeah, I mean, it'd be great if it was just completely independent. You get the raw story and whatever. But I also, there are two things on this. I was actually having a conversation about this morning with a documentary filmmaker who's done a bunch of 30 for 30s and stuff like that. And you know, this came up and my feeling is first, you're not getting anything unless Jordan has some, because it's his footage. Like this is stuff that's, you're not going to get the documentary at all. And then the second thing is it's not like ESPN is hiding this. It's been well documented where this stuff came from. And the process of getting Jordan to agree to do this has been reported on. And so it would be different if ESPN Films or the network was trying to deceive viewers of this documentary into thinking like Jordan had no input into this or whatever it might be, but nobody's doing that. So I don't have a problem with it really at all.
Yeah, it did make sense. And now Ramona's joining us. Momo, everything okay at home?
Yeah, everything's good. My dad's actually over at my house, like sleeping on the couch, doing good. we had a little scare this morning, but
yeah, I didn't mention your dad's scare, but that's one of the reasons why Ramona couldn't join us, was that your dad had a little health scare, but we're glad to hear he's doing well.
Yeah, he's doing okay for now. You know, hopefully everything's okay for a couple of days here. But yeah, you know, I was just listening to your conversation about The Last Dance, and it's interesting, like how many has somebody who did one of these stories, right? I just did the 30 for 30 on the Donald Sterling situation, right? And it's interesting to think how little people understand about how you actually make something, right? You don't have a documentary without Michael Jordan, right? And you don't have other interviews without Michael Jordan, because most people, if you were to come to them and say, "We're doing a Michael Jordan documentary, can we do an interview?" They're immediately going to call Michael Jordan and say, "Hey, you know about this? Is it cool if I talk to them?" Right? And I don't think they get almost any of the interviews if they don't have Michael on board here.
And like, for example, the Lakers have the Laker Network has a basically it's a three-part series about the road to a dynasty and how they're and they're going to run it in its entirety tomorrow.
Cool.
And I would never say, hey, I'm trying to remember the exact name of it. I think the exact name is Birth of a Dynasty. And it gets all the footage from behind the scenes and it's in four chapters. It's kind of a deep dive. I'm sure one of the reasons they're releasing it is that the popularity of The Last Dance is so good that this is like kind of like the Laker version of that. And I would never say I'm not watching it because the Lakers network did it.
Right.
You know, why does a documentary have to be, I don't know, the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? It can still be good if it's just a story about your team.
Yeah. And I'll tell you this, like, you know, there's we're in an era now where access and players having control of their own stories and narratives is more than it's ever been. Right. It started with the Players Tribune with Derek Jeter. And in a lot of ways, The Last Dance, like Michael Jordan was way ahead of everybody because he's had control of this footage for 23 years, right? Like that was part of the deal. Like he wouldn't have participated in filming it if he didn't have control of it. That was Adam Silver offering that to him. And, you know, I've thought about this a lot, too. Like if somebody was making a documentary about something I was involved in, right, I think I would be flattered if they asked for my opinion. But I think I would be, I think I would be upset if they didn't, right? Like, if you're, if somebody's making a documentary about you and your team, it's kind of, I don't know, out of school to go around them, right? Like, as if you know what happened more than the people who actually lived it. And so they have their version and their style, and that's kind of part of it now. It's like whoever decides to participate. Usually that's why people wait a long time to do documentaries, because once 10 years, 15, 20 years have passed, people feel a little more inclined to talk about it because they're not, like, still living through it.
Ramona, there's been a lot of conversation today. I'm sure you've seen some of it.
Yeah.
About the, you know, Brian Windhorst did an in-depth piece on what it would entail if they got that bubble up and running, maybe down in Florida. Mm-hmm. There's other, there've been other reports today that, Adam Silver, and this was included in Brian's piece too, Adam Silver will not do anything if they can't get tests that are easily available for the whole country. Where's your level of optimism stand right now on to whether or not they're going to finish this season?
So I'm kind of, I'm in a different place on it, honestly. I feel like I've been very optimistic up, you know, and I still am optimistic that we're going to get something in, but I've kind of turned around on the idea of a bubble.
Really?
Yeah. I thought up until yesterday, and not
what changed your mind.
A couple of conversations I had, a couple of important conversations I had. And it really changed. I thought it was the question was to bubble or not to bubble. Right. And, somebody turned me around on that and said, I don't know if the bubble is really even on the table. Right. I think that's sort of something that, the media has created, this idea has been kind of perpetuated out there, and it's almost a straw man kind of argument. Because I'm starting to believe, just based on several conversations I've had in recent days, that like it's not going to look like a bubble. It's going to be a lot more about testing and a lot about how much you can trust people who are participating in this. But I just don't think the people involved, like players especially, are in a place where they want to give up their freedoms here and go
really?
Be sequestered.
Even if it meant
weeks.
No finish to the season.
No, I don't think I would say that. I think that there's going to be a place where we're going to get testing in line, where anybody who needs to get tested is going to get tested, right? It's already starting to happen in LA County. Once testing gets up to a certain capacity, you're going to have best practices, right? You're going to be asked to limit interactions, obviously, and not do anything risky or go out or whatever it is. But you're going to have some level of trust in people coming and going. I think it's going to be a little bigger than a bubble. I don't see this idea of like players living sequestered in a hotel. People have turned me around on that the last couple of days. I'll put it that way, right? And I think that our discussions about bubble and not bubble might actually be the wrong discussion. The right discussion might be, what level of risk are you comfortable with, and how do you get to the highest level of comfort with that risk? Because there's even in a bubble, there's no scenario in which the risk level is zero.
Wow.
Right. But I mean, I would say though, I think we have to kind of understand what bubble means. It's like, mm-hmm. you know, are you quarantining people in a hotel where nobody can leave their room or nobody can leave the MGM or whatever? Like, that's not something that people are going to agree to. The Disney World thing is a different kind of thing. Like, okay, you're kind of confined to the property.
Yeah.
But that can mean the swimming pools. That can mean, you know, honestly, if the optics weren't so bad, it could mean the park. Like, there are all kinds of places to go. You can go golfing there. Like, that's a different kind of bubble. That's a bubble technically because it's private property. You can control access in and out and all that stuff, but it's still kind of a little island, but that's different than Vegas. So, we've kind of constructed in our heads what this means. There are scenarios that are more risky than others. If you have to fly people around the country, that's riskier because you risk bringing virus from places where it isn't to place, or from where it is to places where it isn't. And so, you know, I just feel like certain plans can be made, and you don't have to take the entire NBA and put them in Disney World for 3 months. There are only two teams are going to have to be there the whole time, and everybody else can go home. Like, I think this is workable in that way.
It could be, but Ramona, let me ask you this. So, like, I don't know if you're familiar. We had Bob Nightingale on this show this week.
Yeah.
And Bob said that what baseball is talking about is allowing, it would still be no fans, But allowing the, for example, the Dodgers to play in Dodger Stadium,
right?
They would restrict travel the best they could. If and by the way, they would, you know, and you wouldn't have to have a two or a three game series. Maybe you have a five or a six game series to limit the number of trips. But you're keeping people basically in their home cities. Is that what you're thinking basketball might be looking into?
I would say it like that. You know, I think here's what I'm trying to wrap my head around right now. And I'm trying to explain, because I've been in the camp, guys, the same as everybody else. Like, oh, how would we keep the bubble? How would we do it? You know, the idea that we would even be in home cities or traveling at all seems scary. I think over the next month, all of us are going to have to get comfortable with some level of reemergence into the world, right? And what, how you would ever do that, how you would ever feel comfortable doing that, how you're going to do that. Because the choice, you know, I think we have this expectation that we're going to have a vaccine in a year, but you also have to consider a reality in which you may not have a vaccine for 4 years, right? Like, that's like the soonest they've come up with vaccines for other similar diseases, right? And one person I was speaking to the other day was like, look, if you don't have all the data yet, you don't know how serious this really is. You don't know how fatal it is, because we don't have enough data in terms of testing. And there's going to be a choice in a way as we reemerge from this, as with social distancing is always going to kind of be with us for the next year or so until we either have treatment options or a vaccine, where you're going to cautiously reengage with the world, right? And I think the NBA, baseball, all of the above are kind of getting to that place where, you know, locking yourself away in your homes with no physical contact with anybody is almost not realistic, right?
It's just, right. And I think, you know, people are, you know what, Ramona, I completely agree with you. I think people are turning the other way on it now.
I'm not there yet. I don't want to leave my house. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to go anywhere. Nope. And even if they told me that you could go someplace, I would be scared to go someplace. Right. But let's see what, like, here's what I'm hoping. And what I'm thinking about this is that if the cases continue to decrease around us, right, that means it's on the right side of the slope. If we don't have another spike, then right, you're going to have to, like, consider a world in which we've all made our peace being in this bubble. You know, if you knew right now the bubble was would end on January 1st, 2021. Right. 2021. Then I would be like, OK, you know what? I could get my head around that. We could find ways of existing in a bubble till then. But you don't know that. Like, you don't know it's January 21. And I think the higher level conversations that leagues are having right now is, can we get to a place where there is like an acceptable level of risk? And it sounds crazy to put any kind of value on risk on anybody's life. But if you have a certain level of testing where you felt like, you know, a player got test positive, you take them out of circulation until they have consecutive no symptoms or whatever, you know, and maybe not everybody has to be quarantined. Maybe you just test everybody again, you know, and I think they would probably be testing all the time. I don't think testing is actually an issue for the NBA. I know that they have been offered many scenarios by all the testing companies where they can get tests.
No, so it's the optics of testing.
Yeah, it's the optics of testing. And so until the country and the world gets in a better place with this, sports aren't going to rush back. The NBA definitely not going to rush back. But I think we need to frame the discussion differently. And I don't like that either. I was into the bubble idea, you guys. But I've got the last couple of days, I've kind of had some conversations that turned me around on this.
Wow. Well, you've given me a whole new way of looking at this. Okay, I gotta take a break. I gotta get my head around
it. Totally,
I know.
I like. I'm still sending. I'm sending everyone to the happiest place on earth, and we're just doing it that way.
Sounds like you may be the only one going.
I don't know. You have to consider too, like, what you're saying, Ramona, like the need to get something in this year, even if it's not ideal.
Yeah.
And it upsets people, whatever, because there's no guarantee that next year is not going to be interrupted too.
Yeah. And, you know, Woj just put a report out saying that preliminary discussions about next year starting in December. All of these things, guys, are a best case scenario. Okay. Like, that's all a best case scenario. So like the idea that you could even get this season in, that you could start next season in December, like all of that is predicated on this assumption we all have that some kind of antivirals are going to work. There's going to be a vaccine that shows promise fairly soon. And then it's just a matter of clinical trials, that there's a, that there is a light at the end of the tunnel. But like, I hate to say this because it's really depressing when I even think about this, but like, there's not a vaccine for SARS. There was not a vaccine for MERS, right? Like, right. They just kind of went away because they did mitigation efforts where they tested people and people had it and they got quarantined. And then this virus is different in that.
Right. Those weren't as contagious.
Those were not as contagious. And also people who had it showed symptoms. There's not this asymptomatic transmission, which we are experiencing with COVID-19.
All right, I need to go someplace and stick my head in a bucket of ice. You've got me completely thinking. No. I'm glad. This is eye opening. This is really eye opening.
Yeah, I'm just really excited about sustaining my career in sports media. Thank you, Ramona.
All right, Momo. Hey, thank you for checking in, and we hope everybody at your house is doing good.
You.
Give us their best.
That.
All right,
I will.
Okay, coming up next, Van Lathan, who is one of the hosts, Brian, of the new podcast, the new Ringer podcast about The Wire. Heard something on the show he wants to weigh in on, but we'll talk to Van about that and his podcast, which is really good if you haven't heard it yet. That's coming up ESPN LA 710. All right, Mason and Ireland show. By the way, coming up bottom of the hour, J.A. Adande, former LA Times sports writer who was in Chicago when The Last Dance took place, will join us on the show. Right now on the line, Van Lathan, who works at TMZ. And Van, you're doing that new Wire podcast, right?
Way down in the hole. Me and an old ESPN, I guess an ex-ESPN, Jamel Hill, at my new shop at The Ringer. Every single episode of The Wire, we break it down, man. It's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, I heard one the other day, man. It's great. Good for you. I've known Jamel for a long time, and The Wire's a great rewatch. So good for you guys. What made you pick up the phone? What'd you hear?
Okay, so love you guys, and I just want to say that, like, for me, I have to get out of the house and ride around in my car and listen to something to get my mind off everything.
I know you feel.
That I do that with. The Tropic Thunder thing was kind of what made me call in, for a couple of reasons. Number one, first of all, I love the movie Tropic Thunder. Robert Downey Jr. is my favorite actor. Love the movie. Loved it then. Love it now. I think it's well written. He was nominated for Academy Award for that performance, and he earned every bit of that. However, I think that once things like that happen, I got the joke then, I get the joke now. I think it's completely okay for us to look at things that have happened historically and analyze whether or not they were okay.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, as no one's got their pitchforks out for Robert Downey Jr., as long as you can have a sort of heady and rational discussion about something, you should be able to have a cultural sort of a discourse about whether or not it's cool. Like, I'll give you an example that you guys made. For example, I heard one of you guys say that John Wayne was quote-unquote old-fashioned. That's a mischaracterization of John Wayne. John Wayne was quoted as saying that he believes in white supremacy until black people have progressed far enough in order to be able to govern themselves. What tends to happen is when someone says something like that, that's a viciously racist statement. There's no other way to look at that. It's viciously racist. Even at the time, it was viewed as viciously racist, right? What happens is that because we love John Wayne, my father loves John Wayne, people love John Wayne, we tend to remember him as, oh, he's old-fashioned, he was backwards, those were the times. I think it's fair to look at him. I think it's fair to look at the performance. If there's any outrage, then we talk about that however way that we talk about it. But I think for a long time, like black people, women, Latinos, we kind of get told to kind of shove it for even bringing it up. And I'm not saying that that's what you guys were doing. I'm just saying that it's blackface. It's worth a discussion.
Right. But Van Lathan is with us. He's at The Ringer now doing a podcast with our old friend Jamel Hill, Way Down in the Hole, which is about The Wire. If you, first of all, if you've never seen The Wire, go back and watch it. I did it about 2 years ago for the third time, and I noticed stuff all the time that I didn't notice in the first couple times I watched it. But, Van, back to your point, you mentioned as long as you don't come with pitchforks after Robert Downey Jr., that's clearly an impression I got. That's why I brought it up. I think people are coming with pitchforks for Robert Downey Jr., and I think that's ridiculous. He was acting in a movie, and he played a character, and he did it well, and it was a satire. So can you separate those two things? Can you have the discussion that you want to have and not tarnish Robert Downey Jr.?
Well, I think outrage in and of itself is exhausting, and I think it, a lot of times outrage all over the place de-intellectualizes the lessons that you can learn from these things. And so, like for me personally, I would really love to move away from just the triggered outrage culture. However, it's very difficult, especially when you consider the stakes, right? So there's an argument to be made that there's not an innocent way to do blackface. And it's a very strong argument. There's an argument to be made that in order for that blackface wouldn't miss. See, in terms of being a black American back in the day when your life wasn't valued and when everything about you was kind of minimized, it was easy to kill you. It was easy to lynch you. It was easy to pull you out of your home in front of your family, put a cross in your yard and hang you. And all of these microaggressions, the blackface, the terms, the slurs, they lead into that dehumanization. So there is a method of thinking that says all of them should just be stopped and not even played with. In the particular case of this, I think Robert Downey Jr., and I've heard him talk about this before, he took the role after doing due diligence with the friends that he had around him, and he didn't think that he was in any way being disrespectful, and that matters. What kind of bothers me sometimes is the squelching of the discourse from either side. Meaning, this is crazy. It was 10 years ago or whatever. Everybody get over it. No, there's something to be said about that. And I'll say something else just real quick. Is we do have a different forum to discuss it now. In 2008, these things were discussed in headlines or maybe on talk shows. But we have Twitter now. There's more interconnectivity now. There's more discussion now about whether or not things should be done. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Well, first of all, we appreciate you picking up the phone and weighing in on it. It's a unique perspective. And hey, just out of curiosity, if you mentioned Robert Downey Jr. is one of your favorite actors and that and you've heard him talk about it and he went to his friends around you, had he come to you and said, hey, here's a script. It's a satire. It's Tom Cruise. It's McConaughey. It's Ben Stiller. I'm thinking about doing it. Would you have told him not to do it?
I said, Tony Stark, don't do it. I was like, I've been watching Robert Downey Jr. since he was in a movie called Chances Are way back in the day.
Molly Ringwald, yeah. Cybill Shepherd was in that one, yeah.
Yeah, Cybill Shepherd and Ryan O'Neal way back in the day, Weird Science and all that stuff. I was like, don't do it. But you know what? If I'm being honest with you, I watched the movie and I laughed.
Yeah,
but what's funny about it, Van, is that this is what I think separates it from the John Wayne thing. That's why I brought it up. Like John Wayne's views were problematic then. Like fewer people cared, but there were plenty of people around who were like, no, that's just racist. I should have been a little more explicit, just called him a racist when I was sort of used old faction, very tongue in cheek. But that's why I brought him up. He was problematic then. If you were someone who cared about that sort of thing. When Robert Downey Jr. did that role in 2008 in blackface, it's not like blackface was acceptable. It was the context in which they did. It was a very risky choice, and it was very controversial in the moment. But that wasn't something that was still being legislated. It was a comedic point that you either kind of think lands or doesn't land. But, part of the problem was the person who sent out the tweet that kind of started the controversy over the weekend just saw the picture of Robert Downey Jr., hadn't actually seen the movie, went back, saw the movie, and was like, oh, I get it. And you're right. You can still argue that it shouldn't be done. And that is a totally valid perspective. But, I think once you see the movie, you understand, first of all, he's the fool. It's not a condoning of blackface. Robert Downey Jr.'s character, the actor, is the fool there. But at the very least, you got to see the movie.
Yeah, true. Last thing I'll say is if you remove the blackface equation from Tropic Thunder, the most famous dialogue in Tropic Thunder between Robert Downey Jr. and Ben Stiller would completely not fly. I'm not even going to repeat what it is that they say.
Right.
It was funny then. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. There is no way that when he's telling him not to go full, we know what he's talking about.
Yeah.
No way you could do that now. No
you know what's Van, you know what's interesting about that? I'm the father of a special needs kid, so I'm super sensitive to that word. And to your point, going back to what you said when you first started, I laughed at that scene. I thought it was really funny. But you're right. It would offend a lot of people. Hey, how far in are you and Jamel on The Wire? How many episodes have you done so far?
We've done, I think, that have been put out. We do like two or three at a time when we tape them. I think that we're on episode like five or six.
Oh, good for you.
I mean,
keep it up,
Monday,
man.
We're finished with the season now.
Yeah, I can't wait to hear that. You're going to roll through all the seasons, right? All five?
All of them, including season two, Wire haters. We're going to do it as well.
Hey, man, thank you for picking up the phone and weighing in. Stay safe.
I will. Thank you guys for keeping me sane.
All right, man. There's Van Lathan from The Ringer. Coming up next, Jay Adande, who you guys probably know him from the LA Times, but he was a reporter in Chicago when The Last Dance was going on. We'll get J.A. in here next. Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. I'm John Ireland. ESPN LA, 710. Mason and Ireland show. Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. We've had a lot of stuff going on. We talked to Kenneth Murray from the Chargers. We talked to Ramona. Ramona is and she talks to a lot of people, is no longer buying the bubble. She thinks the bubble idea that's being floated out there on ESPN and Yahoo is unlikely. She does think there could be a season, but she doesn't think it'll happen in the bubble. And then Van Lathan just joined us. Van is the new host at The Ringer of the Way Down in the Hole, the Wire podcast, and made some good points about the Tropic Thunder thing. And now we're going to try and track down Jay Adande. Brian, are you up to speed on The Last Dance? Have you seen all four?
I have. We record our podcast for The Athletic on Sunday, so I generally have to wait until the next day to watch. But I am fully caught up.
Is there anything so far that surprised you that you absolutely didn't know?
Not necessarily like in broad strokes. You know, you kind of know the story of and Reinsdorf and that last season, the ultimate. But it's like it was a while ago now. We're talking, you know, 1998. That was, somebody do the math for me. We're talking, what, 22 years, give or take? It's been a while, so you forget some of the details. I'd forgotten some of the details about Rodman's vacation. Those were interesting. And, you know, I didn't realize that Chicago before Jordan got there was a traveling cocaine circus. I mean, that was certainly true of the NBA at the time, but I didn't know it was specific to them. I always wanted to be part of one of those, but I'm a little old for that now.
I was going to say,
so,
life's not
a ton of. Yeah, no, but I like to say I feel like my cocaine window has closed. Like, there's a certain part of your life where if you haven't done certain drugs...
There you go.
I'm 44 years old. Nobody starts doing
well,
cocaine.
Well, and you survived the 80s. Why would you want to hurl yourself back into them? Yeah.
If I had a coke problem in the 80s, it would have been problematic. It was 10.
Good point. One thing that I think The Last Dance shows, and I'm glad it's showing it, and I've been talking about it throughout the week, is for whatever reason... Phil Jackson is thought of in some circles as a guy who got lucky with great rosters. Like, anybody could have won in Chicago with Michael Jordan. Anybody could have won with the Lakers with Shaq and Kobe. But the facts are completely the opposite of that, Brian. Other guys did have a chance to win with Shaq and Kobe, and they weren't able to do it. Other guys did have a chance to win in Chicago with Michael Jordan. Phil was his third coach. You know, as the Last Dance outlines, from Stan Albeck to Doug Collins to Phil. And I think that Phil won one Coach of the Year award. He won 11 titles, and he won one Coach of the Year award because I think the narrative on him is, well, he had unbelievable players. What I think you're seeing on The Last Dance is that Phil had a unique way of team building and a unique way of getting people to do things that they didn't at first want to do, and that was key to both the six titles in Chicago and the five in L.A. I'm not sure that another coach has even close to that run.
I think the argument that, I mean, look, Phil had Michael, he had Scotty, he had Shaq, he had Kobe, he had Powell. He had phenomenal players. Find me a coach that wins multiple titles with garbage. I mean, Red Auerbach, like, you know, the eighth guy on those rosters was in the Hall of Fame. Like, so he had plenty of guys. Pop had Tim Duncan and David Robinson and Kawhi Leonard. And like, they all have guys. It's not easy to win with great players and sustain winning with great players. And I think the reason he hasn't won Coach of the Year is because it's assumed his teams would always be good. And we like to give it that to the coach that leads a team that we didn't think would be good. But yeah, you could give it to Pop every year. You could give it to Phil every year. And it's the idea that this is easy to coach Michael, to coach Kobe, to coach Shaq is absurd.
Well, if you go on social media, it's a legitimate debate. Or if you just talk to anybody who's ever worked in the NBA, it's a legitimate debate. Who is a better coach, Phil Jackson or Greg Popovich? And it's not close. Phil Jackson won 11 titles. Pop won 5. Phil Jackson, take any 20 years of Pop and Phil. Mm-hmm. Phil and Pop, we have the unique perspective, Brian, of they competed head-to-head when they had elite players. And I think Phil head-to-head in the playoffs against Pop is 4-1. It's not a debate. They had opportunities to do it. You know, in a 20-year window, Pop was great. He had a lot of winning seasons. Phil never had a losing season. One of the reasons Pop got Tim Duncan is because he had a last-place team when David Robinson
got hurt. When David Robinson got hurt. I mean, it's a preference thing. I mean, like, you know, do you prefer the San Antonio run of sustained excellence in one place where, you know, you're kind of recreating this team? And Pop's been very flexible in how he's done it. He's had stars that, you know, they built the team around Duncan and they moved away from Duncan to Ginobili and Tony Parker. Like, he's been very flexible in the types of teams that he has win. And you know, as good as Tim Duncan is and was, and as good as some of these other players have been, you know, none of them are as good as Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen. If one thing we're learning from this documentary, Scottie Pippen might still be underrated, even when we all sit back and consider how good he was. You know, Phil, I think, had more elite talent than Pop did. But the idea, but like, okay, which do you like? You know, which what kind of wine do you like? Do you like Cabernet? Do you like Merlot? Like, there's no necessarily right or wrong answer to it if you're dealing with good enough stuff. And both of those guys are incredible. Like, I don't understand the desire to knock them down because they had the tools that were necessary to do the thing that we praise people for. Like, without it, yeah, they wouldn't have. Phil didn't win when he didn't have great players, you know, and when it was just Kobe and Smush Parker. They didn't win titles. I get it. But nobody would have. So, you know, you could argue that those guys wouldn't have gone, you know, to the playoffs even if Phil wasn't there.
I just think the debate over who is a better coach, Greg Popovich or Phil Jackson, it sounds like you think it's a debate. I don't. I think by any...
Phil was more successful, but I don't know if he's better. I'm not... It's like when you say Kobe is the seventh best guy and I say he's the ninth best guy. Somebody else says he's the fifth. I don't know what any of that means. It's like they're both, you know, that like tier of ultra elite NBA coaches. And for me, I just sort of leave it there.
And the other thing that's weird is Phil never really got much of a tree. Pop, you know, right now there's two head coaches in the league. Well, Steve Kerr, you kind of got to give a point to each coach because Kerr played for both guys. But right now Phil's tree is Steve Kerr and Luke Walton. And Pop's tree has a little bit more to it. I mean, he's got Budenholzer, you know, came out of Pop's tree. Who's the guy in Memphis that's having a really good year? Taylor. He's like a Coach of the Year candidate. Borrego in Orlando is, or in Charlotte is, or no, he's in, where is Borrego now?
Borrego is in...
Is he in Orlando?
Is he in Orlando now?
Yeah, he's a Pop guy. So Pop's always had a little bit more of
and
a
And that, by the way, that's part of the reason that Pop sometimes gets that love is because he's more popular around the league and with media than Phil.
And he's still coaching. He's still coaching. That helps,
yes,
too.
Absolutely.
All right, coming up top of the hour, 5 o'clock Fast Track. Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. ESPN LA 710. Mason in Ireland show. Brian Kamenetsky in for Mace. I saw this story today, Brian, and, you know, there's a theory I think most people have that everyone has their price. That, you know, there's a lot of things that you wouldn't do. You know, there was that story in The Last Dance about how Jerry Reinsdorf said to Michael Jordan, if there were 10 pills, and Jordan said, I got a headache. And Reinsdorf said, if I had a bottle with 10 pills and 9 of the pills would kill your headache, but 1 would kill you, would you take a pill? Mm-hmm. And Jordan's answer was, it depends how bad the headache is.
Right.
But there's, like, you and I would never take a pill. We have too much to lose. But what if I came to you and said, I'll give you $1 million. Would you take a pill? 90% chance of it working out for you?
Nope. Wouldn't do it.
Okay. How about $7 million?
Nope.
How about $100 million?
No, I don't think I'd do that.
You wouldn't do it for $100 million?
No, I don't think I would.
I think I would do it for the 7. So my price would be 7. Your price is somewhere north of $100 million.
But you're somebody who would lick his shoe for 30
right.
cents. So, I mean, like,
right.
you know,
I
will, you're wired
I'm willing,
a little differently than
I'm
the rest
willing
of us.
To weigh the odds and then, you know, realize that it could have a horrible outcome. But
right. you're
also realize,
to the action.
Yeah. So it reminded me of this story that I read today. You know who David Falk is?
Sure.
Okay, David
Michael
Falk,
Jordan's agent.
It was Michael Jordan's agent, still is. And David Falk controlled, the easiest way to put this was, is David Falk controlled all the players who were in the original Space Jam. You know, all those mm-hmm. guys, Larry Johnson and Sean Bradley, and, you know, I'm trying to remember who else was in that, but David Falk was a
Barkley and all those guys.
Patrick
yeah.
Ewing, Barkley, he had all those. Mm-hmm. So David Falk was on a radio show in New York this week. And here's a story he told on the radio show. He says, when Michael Jordan was in Asia a few years ago for a Hornets preseason game, a woman from the Philippines offered $7 million to have Jordan appear for the day at a golf event. Jordan, who loves golf, said no. So he turned down $7 million to show up at this golf event. Then Falk goes on to tell this story. A company asked for 2 hours of Jordan's time, plus the right to use his name and likeness. In exchange, Jordan would get $100 million. He turned it down. Here's what Falk says about it.
Wow.
I brought him a deal 3 years ago for $100 million. All he had to do, other than giving his name and likeness, was make a 2-hour appearance to announce the deal, and he turned it down. God bless him. He's been so successful. It gives him an opportunity to do whatever the hell he wants or not to do the things he really doesn't want. I admire that. He's very, very selective in the things he wants to be involved in. But I find that fascinating that he turned down $100 million. I can't think of too many things, Brian, that I would. It sounds like you're more principled than I am. But for $100 million, anything that wouldn't be career ending, I'm probably doing it.
Oh, yeah. No, don't get me wrong, John. There's a lot of stuff I would do for $100 million. A lot of compromises I would make to values.
You wouldn't do
the
90-10. Lindsay, if
no,
I
but I'm not willing to die. 10% okay. is a that's a lot of things happen that only have a 10% chance of happening. I don't want to die. I'll compromise my values for money, but I don't yeah. want to die.
Lindsay, give you a bottle. Yeah. It's got 10 pills in it. 9 of them, you're fine. 1 of them kills you. If I offered you $1 million, would you take a pill?
For a million, no.
What about seven?
I don't know. I would have to really think about it. I think I would try and negotiate for 10, and then I'd probably do it.
But 100, there's no doubt.
Yeah, for sure.
Funch, which one of the where would you take a pill for 7 or 1 or 100? Where would I get you or would I?
I think I'd do it for 1. I think I'd do it for 7. I think I'd do it for 100.
Yeah, I think most people would. Mason would say he wouldn't do it for any amount, but he's lying. He would do it. I mean, if he knew, if he knew he could make.
Well, again, could he do it on social media? If the answer,
right.
If it would be good for his brand, he would do it.
The reason he would do it for $100 million is how many people he could help. He wouldn't keep the money, but he couldn't. There's no way he's turning down $100 million. Lindsay, remind me to ask him that on Monday. But
okay.
The fascinating thing about this is that Jordan is so selective, and he's doing The Last Dance. He's obviously, Brian, not doing it for money. Why do you think he finally caved? Why do you think he's doing it?
I think it's a couple things. I think, first of all, he's far enough away from it that, you know, he has some creative control. So I think that's part of it. He knows the message is not going to be sort of unrestrained anti-Jordanism. But I do think there's an element in here of reminding people what Michael Jordan was, because so many people haven't seen it. Like, you know, I'm 44 years old. I'd forgotten, like, Michael Jordan played college basketball at North Carolina at the era where there was no 3-point line. Like, think about it. Like, that's how long ago he was at UNC. There was no 3-point line in college. He played with James Worthy, who is not somebody we think of as a modern contemporary player. And so, you know, you asked me before, like, what has sort of surprised you about it? Those highlights of, like, 23-year-old, 24-year-old Michael Jordan doing stuff, you're like, oh, damn, I kind of forgot what MJ was.
Unguardable.
Degree,
yeah.
Yeah. To some degree, with, like, with LeBron kind of ascending and people having that conversation, is LeBron the greatest of all? I think you wanted to remind people to some degree what he was, and that there is no... There is no argument here to be made. Michael Jordan is the greatest basketball player that ever was. And so if you're asking me why, I think that's a big part of it.
So I've got a good Michael Jordan story. So right when he bought the Hornets, I'm working sidelines for a game in Charlotte, and James Worthy is at the game, and I'm friends with Worthy. I've known him for a long time. So I walk over to say hi to Worthy, and he's sitting next to Jordan. And he goes, "Hey, John, how you doing, man?" He goes, "Have you ever met Michael?" I go, "No, hey, Michael, pleasure to meet you." And I shake hands with him. And so I had kind of an introduction, you know. And I say to Jordan, I said, hey, Michael, I'm doing Lakers TV. If I only ask you two questions and they're both about Phil Jackson, would you do a hit with me coming back from this commercial? And Jordan goes, "I really don't do that." And Worthy goes, "You should do it, man. He's a good guy." So Jordan goes, "Okay, sure." So I come back. I said, "I'm here with Hornets owner Michael Jordan. Michael, you surprised Phil Jackson still coaching you?" Gives me two great answers. And I go back and sit down. And the producer's really happy. And you know, it went well. And Jordan said some really nice things about Phil. And the PR director at the time in Charlotte was this guy named BJ Evans, who's now in Cleveland. Really good guy. I've known him for a long time. And he walks up to me and he goes, "What the hell just happened?" And I went, "What do you mean?" And I tell him that story. He comes to me, he goes, "Man, you can't ever do that again. I've turned down every interview for Michael for 4 years. He told me never, ever to do." He goes, "I can't believe you did that." And I go, "Man, I didn't even think about it. I'm so sorry." And he goes, "Don't worry about it. Just don't ever do that again." And I think I'm one of the only people who's ever interviewed Jordan on the sidelines, because BJ said he just doesn't want to do it. And right. Had you come to me, I never would have let you do it. You just kind of were in the right place at the right time.
Right. And, you know, that's our motto, of course, in this business is don't ask for permission, beg for forgiveness.
But I didn't even know. I just said, you know, right. he seemed like a good guy and he did it. And you know, it, right. But I mean, I got incredibly lucky. And you never know how the sideline interviews are going to go. I've told the story on the air many times about the time I'm in New Orleans and the director sees Bruce Willis sitting courtside. And he says, "Hey, John, Bruce Willis is sitting courtside. You should go see if he'll do a thing with you." And I go through the same routine, and I get Bruce Willis. I go, "Hey, Bruce, do you mind walking to the end of the court so I'm not, you know, blocking the referee running by?" He goes, "Yeah, sure." So he walks me at the end of the court, and they say, "Okay, we're coming back with Ireland. in 3-2-1. I said, hi, I'm John Ireland. Lakers lead in New Orleans, 38-36. And I'm here with the great actor Bruce Willis. Bruce, what are you doing here? And it hits me, I don't know, 2 seconds later, he's hammered. He's been having a good time. He's just hammered. He goes, make it a great film. Great. And I'm like, what's the name of the film? Red. Great movie. Great cast. Great location. And the producer says in my ear, you're not getting out of this. You got to ask him at least one more thing. And I said, I see you're sitting with the owner, the New Orleans owner, but I know you have a house in L.A. I said, who are you rooting for tonight? He goes, well, I love Kobe, but I got to be gracious to the host. So he kind of saved me on the last one. I go, that's Bruce Willis. Thanks a lot. I throw it back, and Joel Myers goes, John, that's the most insightful interview you've ever done. Back to the game. But you just never knew what you were going to get on the sidelines. And I was lucky enough to stumble into a Michael Jordan interview once.
You didn't get a chance to smell his breath.
No, and it was fine, but I mean, I'm so glad there's no tape. Let's put it this way: if that would have been in the Twitter age, it would have gone viral for sure. By the way, the New Orleans sideline reporter saw me do that, so then he went and got Bruce, and that is on YouTube. Bruce's interview with him, which was a little better. All right, coming up next, 5 o'clock fast track. I got a question for Brian. He's got it for me. We'll get Lindsay in there. We'll get Funches in there. It's all coming up next. ESPN LA 710.